Marvin Landsberg, that's me. You're at the session that's called Ecclesiastes, Wisdom of Experience and Apocalypse. And it's part of the series I've been doing this week and last on William Blake and the Bible that's called, what is the order? Hearing Wisdom, Seeing Wisdom, and Speaking Wisdom. And what I'd like to start with is to put Greg Brown back on. Do you know who he is? He's on Prairie Home Companion a lot. He's from Iowa. And he's got an album. It's a wonderful album where he performs William Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience, the children's poems songs that he wrote, which Blake himself sung and performed, so that they were meant not just to be read, but to be heard. And Greg Brown's version of it is absolutely wonderful. So just to, even though we're starting late, I think it's worth to set the Blake mood. I'm going to show the Blake song that he's singing. I'll turn off the lights and you can follow along and read while you listen to Greg Brown's. I want to get back to that poem, and now that we're going to be cut short, you might have to remind me to get back to it. So if it's getting close to when we end, you say, let's get back to that poem, because I want to say something about that. And that's a grim poem about suffering in England at the end of the 18th century, which William Blake, visionary, poet, painter, artist, was very concerned about. And what I'd like do today is talk about some of that background for that dark vision, which in the context of today we call an ecclesiastical vision, that is ecclesiastical from the sense of the book of Ecclesiastes, which is the primary focus today. I want to look at that book of wisdom and do some reading around in that with Blake reading over our shoulder. That is, because, as I've been talking about, Blake was very interested in the biblical wisdom tradition, its images, its poetic forms, its proverbs, and he incorporates those into his own works, like his Songs of Innocence and Experience and some of his later prophetic works. And just how he does that provides us a model of an aggressive reader-responder to the Bible, which is one of, I think, my answers to the question, why should we continue to read Blake today? Because of that model of an intense reader of the Bible, which, again, if he's coming to conclusions that aren't necessarily yours, they are conclusions constantly that are intriguing, especially in his critique of misery and of a modern industrial society which was just emerging, producing human misery, and what to do about it. And some of his solutions are central to church issues even today. So, I'm not sure if I can get away with telling a joke that my dad told me this week, but I'd like to start. You may have even heard this. Walt Bowman's been telling light bulb jokes this week from the microphone, and I don't think he's told this one, it is, how many Lutherans does it take to change a light bulb? Change?
That's not another Episcopalian joke. I'm getting really tired.
Yeah, right. Well, that's a Lutheran. There must be a Methodist one.
Actually, I thought it was about four. It took one to actually change the light bulb, and three to remember how great the
old. Yeah, that's right. Same version. Anyway, everybody's going to need a Bible. If you don't have one, let me get you one. Is anybody?
Grab one. Anybody else?
And a quick advertisement in the bookstore. We're asked to hawk books here, so I'm going to hold this one up. The bookstore has a few copies of this. Blake's Poetry and Designs. It's a nice book. If you're interested in the poetry of William Blake, it's got a big selection of his works. The Songs of Innocence and Experience are in here, and then a lot of his other stuff that's not as familiar. And then it's got color plates, some of the color illustrations, which are fun to look at. And in the back half, it's got, since this is a critical edition, it's got a few essays about Blake's work, some of the central essays. And also in the bookstore, I have a copy of it, is the book I wrote on Blake, published last year, which is specifically on the things I've been talking about this week, and that is Blake reading the Bible, particularly thinking wisdom books. So that's there too. So what I'd like to get to is Ecclesiastes first, as I said, with Blake reading over our shoulder, and just do some quick characterization, examination, and reading around in that book to get a feeling for the biblical wisdom tradition that Blake is reading and responding to. So if you can find Ecclesiastes, you can find it faster than I can, I think. Where is it? Yeah. And to get a little momentum into Ecclesiastes, I mean, I really sort of have to start with the book of Proverbs first, because this is a more ancient part of the biblical wisdom tradition. Book of Proverbs, I mean, when we're talking about biblical wisdom, we're talking primarily about Book of Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Book of Job, and then a few other places, some Psalms, and then some of the apocryphal books. So it's the books that are full of Proverbs, wisdom statements. And what makes, I mean, what's being referred to when talking about the wisdom tradition, I mean, primarily the base of it, people are usually referring to the Book of Proverbs, and then the response books to the Book of Proverbs, which are Job and Ecclesiastes. So just to get us into Ecclesiastes, since it's responding to the Book of Proverbs, just a couple quick comments about that first. Book of Proverbs is a confident book that's articulating the wisdom worldview that's true of the whole Near East there. There's a lot of continuity between the Proverbs there and other proverb collections, Egyptian books and others. But what it's doing, it's saying, if God is in heaven and God is in heaven, and this is an orderly world because it's an orderly God, then things make sense. And the way they make sense is that if you're good, you'll be rewarded, and if you're bad, you'll be punished. Because God is a just God, and that's the way things will work. So over and over, the book of Proverbs articulates that basic sentiment. In fact, if you just flip back to the book of Proverbs and drop your finger anywhere in there, you'll find the proverb you landed on probably is some restatement of that central principle, which is referred to as the law of distributive justice. That is, God distributes justice in a fair fashion. Good people get rewarded, bad people get punished. So just try that as an experiment. Just poke your finger in any place and read me one you find. Anybody's got one? Go ahead and read it. In the book of Proverbs now, not Ecclesiastes.
A little sleep and a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber.
Okay. And that must be, I mean, later, like in the 20s chapters. The farther in you get, they get even more riddle format. So that one is a bit of a puzzle. But what's the point of that one?
If you're poor, it's your fault.
Yeah. I mean, basically, if you're lazy, you'll be poor. And that shows you God's not holding you in God's favor. Anybody else get their finger on one?
Hear my son and accept my words that the years of your life may be many. Listen and hear and obey the rules, and then
you'll be rewarded for that. You'll be happy. Okay. Anybody else? Anybody else have one?
Hatred stirreth up strife, but love covereth all sins.
Okay. I mean, that's a little bit different. I mean, it's still chopping things up into two halves. Mm-hmm. Don't do this. Do this. Mm-hmm. And the implication behind that always is,
if you honor the Lord, your bars go equal.
Yeah. So that confident view, that articulation of order, is sort of the ground of biblical wisdom. Now, I mean, it's a wonderful vision of a world where God is at work, and yet, I mean, it's not the whole story. I mean, it can't be. You can't just keep telling people this when people are suffering. So you get the book of Job, which is a radical critique commentary on this. It's asking questions about the biblical wisdom the tradition set out here is, how can this be? Job is blasted. He knows he's good. His friends all preach the book of Proverbs to him, and they say, you must have done something bad. And he says, no, I didn't. What conclusions are we to come to? Does that mean, horror of horrors, that God is not in heaven? That God is not a God that loves justice? Or what? And I mean, that's what the book of Job is constantly asking in its powerful, dramatic fashion. The book of Ecclesiastes is the other response, powerful response to that confident wisdom that's doing something similar to Job, where the speaker is looking around and saying, I see good people suffering and bad people prospering. What in the world conclusions can we reach? So that's the setup for the book of Ecclesiastes, which I'd like to look at some of it and talk about some of the language and literary devices used in here and point to some things that Blake will pick up on and be interested in and draw into his late 18th century vision, which I think you can already see. I mean, that grim song that was being sung in Holy Thursday about misery and children suffering and wondering how this can be comes straight from Ecclesiastes. Now, one other comparative note about the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes. The book of Proverbs starts with this framing device, and you get a little bit of brief narrative first that sets it up. And the book of Proverbs are set up as being spoken by a particular figure. She identifies herself as Lady Wisdom. So the speaker of the book of Proverbs is Lady Wisdom, and she, in the brief mythic parts there, is said to be actually the personification of wisdom, and therefore the ancient consort of God, who God created first. Before God created anything else, he created wisdom with his speech, and then she becomes his speech, and she speaks these proverbs. So there's this sort of brief mythic frame that's introduced there. And we're not going to have time to take a look at that. But in Ecclesiastes, you get a bit of a mythic frame set up, too, about who's speaking. And it's a little bit contradictory. But, I mean, we know from the tradition, I mean, who speaks the book of Ecclesiastes? I mean,
Solomon,
yeah. I mean, it's the Proverbs of Solomon. And I mean, Solomon's name is associated with the book of Proverbs, too. I mean, sort of in the mythic tradition, all things go back to their origin point, and Solomon is the great mythic purveyor of wisdom. So even though, I mean, they're not all Solomons, the frames will say that. But the language used in the mythic frame here in Ecclesiastes is the Solomon voice, and it's a male voice speaking these proverbs, so it doesn't pick up the Lady Wisdom speech from the book of Proverbs, partly because this is a different wisdom being articulated here. I mean, you can't have a wisdom of experience being articulated by Lady Wisdom, the ancient consort of God, who's explaining this confident wisdom. I mean, this is a human wisdom here that says the world doesn't quite make sense to me. And the Hebrew, and where the title of Ecclesiastes comes from through the Greek, Ecclesiastes, It's not exactly sure what the term means, but if you've got notes in your Bible, it says something like Hebrew for the beginning lines of this, where it says the words of the teacher. The teacher is another translation of it, is Kohelet or Koheleth, which comes across as teacher. But what it is, it's interesting, it's a feminine form of a noun, which the exact translation from is not even clear anymore, but has something to do with an assembly or the verb to gather. So it's kahal, and to gather together an assembly of people, getting the term Ecclesiastes, an ecclesiastical group, a church group. So Ecclesiastes is a gathering of wisdom, and Koheleth is someone who gathers wisdom together. That speaker's is important when Blake comes to read this, because Blake is always interested in sort of this mythic vision, and he's interested in metaphors for how we're to understand God. And he'll be real interested in this Lady Wisdom figure because, I mean, that's not something that's emphasized in the tradition or is developed very, very highly. But it is something that Blake will say, wow, I mean, I like to think about what's the consequence of thinking about wisdom as a feminine speech act of God. So he'll pick up on that more. A couple more things about how this book works. And I tend to read it a little bit differently with Blake over my shoulder than some of the traditional commentaries on Ecclesiastes, and I'll try to just point out to where I part company with some of the more traditional commentaries. But if we just take a look, what happens in the first couple chapters of Ecclesiastes is you get this narrative frame where Koheleth is telling you Koheleth's story. And the story is, I've tried a bunch of things, I've tried to understand the book of Proverbs, and what I find and what I conclude is that the book of Proverbs wisdom is not correct. The good don't prosper, the evil do prosper, what can we do about it? And he then tells this quick story about what he has tried to do. And the book of Job gives you this same story about a new learner about this actuality of experience, and Ecclesiastes gives you someone who's gone to college and graduated in experience and now can write the book on it. So he's not a recent learner. He's jaded, he's cynical, he's complaining. So a couple of the passages that we think of and remember, I mean, the refrain that's spoken constantly throughout Ecclesiastes, I mean, any lines come out of your memory from this?
Yeah, how about the tail end of chapter 2?
Yeah.
Starting at 24.
Okay.
It looks like he sums it up there. He says, there is nothing better for a man than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil.
Yeah.
This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment?
Yeah.
So man, God gives wisdom.
Now, the other one that we're all familiar with is in the King James, I think it was vanity.
Yeah.
All is vanity and sometimes it's meaninglessness.
Yeah, I mean, then. So, yeah, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. All human endeavor is vanity. And, I mean, that is a very grim refrain, which when you read this book, I mean, it's interesting even to think, I mean, what a vision in here. And where's God in this vision, even? I mean, and what happens after the first several chapters is the collection of Proverbs, which there isn't any much more narrative development that the scholars can agree on what provides the order for that. You just get these constant articulations of that refrain, all is vanity. And in chapter 9, verse 2 and 3, just to point you to a couple of places, you get a complete rejection of the law of distributive justice that you see in the Bible. So, in, again, law of distributive justice, if you're good, you'll be rewarded. If you're bad, you won't. Here in 9:2-3, and I hope I'm in the right spot, what does it say? Everything that confronts them is vanity, since the same fate comes to all, to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to those who sacrifice and those who do not sacrifice. The same end comes to all. And he's thinking about everyone dies, but part of the implication in some of these other ones too is that, I mean, even in material terms, you won't be rewarded on this earth as it was hoped that you would. And the 60s folk song that comes out of Ecclesiastes about to everything there is a season, turn. When you think of that song, I mean, and to me, I mean, that brings back sort of this nice feeling. To everything there's a season, turn. I mean, that sounds like an orderly, God has imposed an order on the world. That's in here. Where is it?
Chapter
3. Yeah, 3, 1 through 8, thanks. I mean, the way that functions in here, I mean, isn't quite the way it comes across in the folk song. I mean, the world's an orderly place and it's nice, there's a place for everything. I mean, that sounds like something that you might associate with the book of Proverbs, not Ecclesiastes. But here, I mean, the poetry is wonderful too. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up. And we go through the end, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace, and then goes on and on. What's the conclusion? Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. I mean, the point of that prayer, that hymn to cycles, is that we live in an endless cycle of despair and violence, and the impersonal cycles of nature are what the speaker sees around him and doesn't see the intervening hand of God very clearly in what's going on. So it's not really, in most of the commentaries and certainly the way Blake's going to read that, I mean, it's not a confident prayer of gratefulness for the cyclic order of the universe, but it's a statement of despair and an expression of the necessity for a stoic endurance. How do you get through life? You endure. And yeah,
I'm struck by your statement about the impersonal cycles of nature, and that can be seen sort of two different pairs of eyes. It can either be seen as a blessing, as a reminder that we heard from Psalm 104 the other day. That's for, God takes the breath away and it's gone, and then God breathes back and there's life again. Can you say something about, and this is a big question, but nature and Blake in the sense of is are the cycles of nature seen as a negative thing which bequeaths to us?
Right.
Futility, or are the cycles of nature seen as a thing of promise?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, you think Blake, as an English romantic poet, at least that's what he's usually thought of. I mean, think of Wordsworth and the romantic poets. I mean, they like nature. They go out there and wade around in the stuff, and they find this transcendental God there. I mean, Blake's sort of view of nature isn't like Wordsworth's at all in that fashion. I mean, in that way, he's not even a romantic. I mean, certainly he is in other respects. I mean, one of his proverbs is, where man is not, nature is barren. So he doesn't look out and see leafy green things and see necessarily, on one hand, sort of God, and yet, I mean, he's got other proverbs. It says, when thou seest an eagle, thou seest a portion of genius, lift up your head. But what he's constantly thinking about is the material senses closed down and are only part of what true vision is all about. If you use your imaginative poetic vision and look at anything, whether it's nature or the Bible or someone else, you can be opened up into this explosive, apocalyptic, visionary world and experience God. So, I mean, that question about point of view, I mean, that's going to be a key one to Blake, and it's already set up in the wisdom tradition. I mean, here's the Book of Proverbs point of view, here's the ecclesiastical point of view. Which one is it? Which one's true? The canon saves both. If you want to count books, I mean, there's Ecclesiastes and Job, more misery than there is confidence in the wisdom tradition. But the Book of Proverbs is a long book that needs a lot of countering to explore what the consequences are going to be. Now, Ecclesiastes does provide some answers. I mean, Job asks these questions, And at the end, God shows up, and in something quite similar here, talks about the creation. God says, where were you, Job, when I built this place? You weren't around. Who are you to ask me anything? So Job shuts up. How can you confront God and say anything? But it's a very different vision of the creation than you get in Genesis, where humans are right in the midst of the creation, in the center of creation. In Job, at the end, you get this speech where God is saying, pipsqueak people, get out of the way. You're not very important in the scheme of things. And here, with this impersonal cycles of nature business too, that seems to be part of this.
There's also one thing I think you have to consider is that from the standpoint of the time when Ecclesiastes and all the Proverbs kind of stuff was written, there wasn't much thought in terms of eternal life and resurrection. Certainly that was a much later concept to come in post-exilic.
Yeah, right.
The Pharisees in about Jesus' time that people even considered a concept of resurrection and life after death.
Right, and that's...
That puts all of this stuff in a very different light.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that too is the end of the book of Ecclesiastes, which I want to take a quick peek at, and then we will get back to Blake, because that is part of how Ecclesiastes will end. I mean, the narration you get at the beginning part is Koheleth says, okay, I've tried this, I've tried building this great city, it didn't give me order and pleasure. I tried wine, women, and song, and it didn't work. I tried being wise, and that didn't work. So what have I got left? Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. But, again, in some of the commentaries on Ecclesiastes, I mean, it's hard to know sort of what conclusion the thing leads to, but I think the way Blake wants to read it, and how Blake will read the end, and I kind of like how he is reading the end. See where I want you to peek at. Chapter 8, you get this apocalyptic vision that starts to intervene in some real unusual ways into this collection of Proverbs of experience. And let me just summarize first, and then see if I can point you to a couple places to take a look at. But I mean, it's a strange experience just to read this book cover to cover, because at times when you're reading this, you get all these proverbs of despair. But every once in a while, and the same thing happens in Job in a very weird fashion, you get a startlingly different vision smashed up right up against this wisdom of despair. All of a sudden, Koheleth is saying a few proverbs that sound like they belong in the book of Proverbs. God is orderly, and God will make sense, and God will reward the good. And in the context that you've just been reading, you say, how can that be? How could the same person be saying that and have just been telling us that vanity, vanity, all is vanity? In fact, usually after you get those brief insertions, then that vanity phrase will come in and say, even this is vanity. So there's these moments of an attempt at hope and then this shutting down of even that's vanity. But I think what Blake will pick up on, and because this is the way he likes to read, These insertions often are insertions of this positive view in a proverbial fashion, which seem unexplained. So looking ahead, I mean, that's what Blake will do in some of his works. He'll write all this stuff, these songs of despair, and all of a sudden, in the middle of all this, there's this small proverb that doesn't belong. And he's doing it because he sees it happening in Ecclesiastes, and he's doing it because there's power in the articulation of wisdom. And there's power in the articulation of fallen wisdom. And if you only utter fallen wisdom, you're reinscribing this cycle of despair. But if you can somehow maintain confidence and some faith, or you can substitute other terms, then there is hope involved here. So at the end of Ecclesiastes, you get some real interesting apocalyptic imagery in 12:7. It's where I just point you to, and then we'll have another look at Blake. So the end of Ecclesiastes starts focusing on end times, and then that seems to be part of its answer to the question of how are we to understand the book of Proverbs. our conclusion can be it's all vanity, or maybe the Book of Proverbs' wisdom is, well, we won't be rewarded in this world. We won't be rewarded in material terms now, but the reward will come someday. Someday, I mean, just as you're saying, someday it will make sense, but don't expect profit now. So you get 12:7. Right above that is some of the apocalyptic imagery that gets tossed in here. I guess it starts earlier. It's the beginning of 12. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of troubles come and the years draw near you when you will say, I have no pleasure in them. I mean, that's a key line too. Remember when you were innocent. Remember the days when you used to believe all this stuff before you were experienced. And just remembering that is important. So having been innocent once, you need to think back and recall it. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars darken and the clouds return with the rain, in the day when the guards of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the women who grind cease working because they are few, and those who look through the windows see dimly, when the doors on the street are shut and the sound of the grinding is low, and one rises up at the sound of a bird and all the daughters of song are brought low, and when one is afraid of heights and terrors are in the road, and here's some apocalyptic imagery you'll see in other places, the almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails, because all must go to their eternal home, and the mourners will go about the streets before the silver cord is snapped, and the golden bowl is broken, and the pitcher is broken at the fountain, and the wheel at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the breath returns to God who gave it. I mean, there's this kind of end times apocalyptic imagery that, I mean, remember your innocence, and it'll make sense someday when all this is wrapped up. But then here's this voice, vanity of vanities, says the teacher, all is vanity. So you get this sort of, I mean, in an interesting way, that self-criticism of this experienced view. So the speaker's saying, you have to remember this innocence. You can't think now in any other terms. In fact, even when I'm thinking about apocalypse, all I can say is, all this is vanity. And yet still, I mean, the way I'll read Ecclesiastes there, because of those brief flashes of confident wisdom, is that, I mean, there's still hope within there. So what the book is presenting to you is this fallen vision, which you're not meant to adopt, but you're meant to persevere, and if you can, sort of find the glimpses of hope we've even amongst that. Now, and then the thing wraps up with a similar vision. So how you ultimately read Ecclesiastes, whether there's much hope there or is all despair, the way Blake is going to want to read it is to say, at odd moments, there's this confident voice and there's this recommendation of innocence that used to be. And it's in the power always of speech to make things happen, the way Blake will read the wisdom tradition and Jesus' use of it. So he'll respond to this in a number of ways. And with the 10 minutes left that I want to look at is with his Songs of Innocence and Experience. And tomorrow, what I want to talk about is his long and unpublished prophetic book that he wrote called The Four Zoas, which I doubt if anybody here has read. I haven't read it in the last 5 years, and I don't know that I will again. It's sort of a long, difficult read, but it's fascinating because what Blake is doing is rewriting the book of Ecclesiastes, I mean, in a very consistent way, and he's responding to some of the type of use of speech that's going on here. That's what I'll show tomorrow, but what I want to get back to is Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience, which is also in the bookstore, the facsimiles of the Blake's illuminated poetry book for children. And if you just think about this for a minute, Blake's Songs of Innocence, an experience that he did early in his career, the Songs of Innocence are framed as a response to the Book of Proverbs, the naive wisdom of children who know that the world's an orderly place, and that God rewards you if you're good, and that good people survive. the Songs of Experience that Blake writes in response to that is the wisdom of Ecclesiastes, and Job says this world is in bad shape. And what's interesting about those, again, Blake will read connections between those two wisdom views so that you can read Ecclesiastes and find confidence in there, impossibly in there. And you can read the book of Proverbs and read it as a book of oppression. From a particular point of view, you read the book of Proverbs and it says the poor are poor because they deserve it, is not exactly a liberating view. And that two viewpoints are what frames Blake's Songs of Innocence and Experience. I've got two poems.
I just remembering the previous, I was much moved by the guy who was a child psychologist who spoke up when you talked about the innocence business. And here in your chapter 12, you said, remember the Creator in the days of your youth. You're supposed to remember your innocence. And he spoke of the terror when these little babies don't ever have that innocence when they're in a home where they never get this solid core of being cared for. And they never ever have it, or they're abused, the most awful things. And he works with them. And how, if they've never had it, how terrible it is. They can't remember that feeling of innocence. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the psychology of that for us today, I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, and I look at my two kids, 5 and 3, this innocence of vision, that's absolutely necessary for them to maintain. I mean, and all the imagery in the Gospels that Jesus uses about the wisdom of children and the confidence of children. And yet, that's not enough because that type of confidence can lead to all kinds of oppression itself. So what Blake will do is he'll say, both those things are true. I don't know which one is more true, but we need them both, just as the wisdom canon saves them both. So here's a pairing of poems. The one that you heard sung, this is Holy Thursday from the Songs of Innocence, and then Holy Thursday from the Songs of Experience is the one that you heard sung. So I'll read that, and you can see if you can follow along. Blake likes to put squiggles everywhere, so it's hard to tell what's a word and what's a decoration. But let me read this, and then I'll just to set up the scene here. Blake lives in London, and every Maundy Thursday, in celebration of Resurrection, they'd march all the kids out of the orphans, out of the poorhouses, and they'd go to St. Paul's Cathedral. If you've ever been there, you can picture that huge place filled up with kids, not on the floor. They put all the sort of people running the show down on the floor, but that upper balcony there, all the children would stand up there in that upper balcony, and they would have been practicing these hymns, and then they would sing out these hymns in praise of God in celebration of the resurrection to come. And with also, I mean, sort of leading up to Easter and Good Friday, too, I mean, that comparison too of the passion and the resurrection to come. So, I mean, you can imagine these piping high voices that we associate with English choirs coming out. And one of Blake's responses to that from the Songs of Innocence is this poem. 'Twas on a holy Thursday, their innocent faces clean, the children walking two and two in red and blue and green. Gray-headed beetles walked before with wands as white as snow, till into the high dome of Paul's they like Thames waters flow. Oh, what a multitude they seem, these flowers of London town. Seated in companies they sit, with radiance all their own. The hum of multitudes was there, but multitudes of lambs, thousands of little boys and girls raising their innocent hands. Now like a mighty wind they raise to heaven the voice of song, or like a harmonious thunderings the seats of heaven among. Beneath them sit the aged men, wise guardians of the poor. Then cherish pity, lest you drive an angel from your door. So then you can see, there they are marching into St. Paul's, all the kids. It's kind of hard to see, but you can see then the church fathers, the leaders with their kind of shepherd's crooks here. And you get some Christian imagery, Jesus leading the little children, and they go into church and they're singing praises. And that poem in the Songs of Innocence is a celebration of that. But it's not just a celebration of that. I mean, that's where you get, I mean, us as experienced readers who know the wisdom of Ecclesiastes can't only be in innocence. We can look at it and nostalgically think about it. But Blake is pairing this with a song of experience and then asking you to go back and read this one and find you can read this also quite cynically itself. And just before we switch to the next one and close there, I mean, most of the imagery in this poem is wonderful and celebratory, but there is some possibilities of another view. I mean, do you see anything else in there?
Well, if you take the all these orphans,
yeah.
And, you know, the orphans were a large problem in
right.
that time, much like the homeless problems that we have today. And here you have all these, the Beatles, the leaders of the church and everything, taking these kids and, yeah, we're going to clean them up for Holy Thursday,
right.
But then the rest of the year we're going to come back and
right.
I mean, that's, they're out of sight.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that is what's happening. I mean, the fact you've got these Beatles, there's kind of the policeman that's there with the club to keep these kids in line. I mean, what they're carrying are wands as white as snow. I mean, there's a little bit of a threat involved there. And these kids are walking two by two in sort of regimented form, I mean, which isn't the form of play that the kids are going to be running around in. And they're in red and blue and green. And there's a nursing student in a class once, when this was being read, and she said, you know, that's the color of bruises, red and blue and green, when kids have been abused. And, I mean, you could be talking about their clothes, but it couldn't. I mean, these kids are abused kids. But nevertheless, I mean, even a fallen reader reading a poem of innocence doesn't negate the innocence of vision and the wisdom of vision in there, and the naivete of knowing and articulating that God is in heaven and we can only respond. But Blake's own response in the song of Roots, where is it? There. Same title, but a different speaker of this poem. This isn't the innocent speaker saying this is a wonderful thing. This is a bitter speaker. And let me read again in the book. So he says, is this a holy thing to see? He's thinking about the song that was just sung. Is this a holy thing to see in a rich and fruitful land? Babes reduced to misery, fed with a cold and usurious thing. Is that trembling cry a song coming from the balcony up there? Can it be a song of joy? And so many children poor. It is a land of poverty. And their sun does never shine. And their fields are bleak and bare. And their ways are filled with thorns. It is eternal winter. For wherever the sun does shine, and where'er the rain does fall, babe can never hunger there, nor poverty the mind appall. So, a completely different perspective on the same event. I mean, that's the prophetic critic saying, this spectacle is to make everybody feel good.
But that last verse sounds like a little bit of hope.
Exactly.
Is that the glimpse of hope that he keeps tucking in?
Yep. I mean, I would say, I mean, that's the tie-in back to Ecclesiastes too. Is Ecclesiastes full of despair at the end? This apocalyptic vision: someday something will happen. And in Blake's view of that, that someday isn't just going to be when Christ comes, whenever again, long in the future. I mean, that moment of vision can happen instantly in the mind of a visionary artist at any moment. So at any moment, any one of you sitting here could have an apocalyptic moment and see the world differently. And what do you see when you see it differently? You see Holy Thursday from innocence again.
Well, in that sense, the liturgy of Holy Thursday combines that paradox in the same way that Passion Sunday, Palm Sunday,
right.
also combines the paradox of the Passion and yet also yeah. the Resurrection, and Holy Thursday holds in tension this very thing. I mean, if the liturgy works right, you come away with that, both the sense of the unity of Christ's disciples around him in love, and yet the paradox that in the irony of Jesus' entry into his Passion. So that's that is Maundy Thursday. That's the way Maundy Thursday yeah. should work.
Right.
It should. Shouldn't be all dismal, nor should it be just isn't this a great dinner.
So somehow, I mean, it's both. I mean, that's the paradox that all the imagery of incarnation is constantly exploring. It's not a removed God. I mean, that's why we can make some sense of this. And for in Blake's vision, I mean, the incarnation is everything. And what the incarnation really means, his best way for understanding that, I mean, is Jesus, but how he thinks of Jesus is the incarnation of the Word, and what Jesus did by becoming the incarnation of the Word was to continue incarnating Word by uttering words, by speaking and preaching, not teaching a bunch of stuff that then needed to be followed, but by speaking God's Word and saying, go and do likewise. So, I mean, the message again, I mean, that Blake sees out of Jesus is to go do the same thing, so he does. Blake is preaching and teaching through his artistic vision, again, so we can look at it, but ultimately, so that we can go out of here and we don't need Blake, what you do is be an artist, be a preacher, be a teacher, you can be a learner too, but so Holden's not a bad place.
Help protect the innocent.
Yeah. To think in those terms. So Holden hilarity is part of that innocence of vision here in a community that's also concerned with justice, and certainly both.
Martin, is the basic structure of the set of poems an unresolved paradox? Is it a confrontation of innocence and experience, and letting, if there is a resolution, it's got to be in our reader response,
yeah,
rather than that he is going to move to some kind of a, resolution of this.
Yeah.
You in a sense suggest that we go out and do that, but that's us resolving it.
Right. I think that's a good summary. So he wrote Songs of Innocence first and published them separately. 4 years later, he wrote Songs of Experience, and then shuffled some of the ones from Innocence into Experience, and then never published it separately again. And it's presenting them both. I mean, and it's part and parcel to his whole vision. I mean, putting things that are contraries to each other in energetic opposition brings life. But if you, I mean, this is, he talks about the marriage of heaven and hell. If you put a negation next to each other, positive and a negative version of something, they cancel each other out, and that leads to death. And Blake's critique of the church is the church too often is setting up negations, good and evil, put them together, you've got nothing. But what you've, and separating the body and the soul from each other, he's constantly saying the church is too Platonic, it's trying to separate those things. You need to put them together, reason and energy, the body and the soul, the imagination and reason. It's only when those are put next to each other that life exists. I mean, and again, this is a statement of the incarnation, and it's a basic mystic assertion that God and us meet in the middle someplace, and we're of the same thing. And that's where the book of Ecclesiastes, some of the most poignant lines in there, she didn't have time to sort of find them all. And there's one that even says, the Hebrew word is interesting. The stuff of God, it says, is in us. The stuff of God is in us. But it's even because of that, we sense that there could be more, and it makes us even sadder when we see this world that we live in. It's even worse because we can understand that, I mean, there is something of a God, but all we can see is vanity. And Blake is putting it together and saying it's with those both together, that's truth. I mean, that's the Passion and Easter, and that's the true mystery.
Can you say a little bit about the paintings, the drawings have always intrigued me. Just to comment a little bit about the three figures.
If anybody needs to take off, you can take off too now. But in all his works, he integrates text and illustration in a way that hadn't been done since medieval manuscripts. And he etched these things himself, so those words he's etched on the plate. I mean, so each letter is sort of part of the art. And I mean, there's long commentary, discussion, speculation on what's the connection. And most of the time, the pictures are not illustrating directly what's on the page. That's one reason why Blake, he made his living as a book illustrator and engraver. He didn't make a great living because he continued to do that for these books people would ask him to illustrate. Illustrate this book for me, and he'd have all these weird things. And they'd say, this flying thing is not in this story about this child. What is it? And he says, well, this is my imagination of these conversations. What do you mean it's not in the story? It's there. That's how I read the story.
It's a great story.
Yeah. If you look at he's got these themes that he's constantly dealing with. And here there's a mother looking down at a child on a rock at the top. So this scene of separation of mother and child, and it looks dead, it probably is. So this dead child. Then over there on the right, there's a mother figure that's removed. One child is hanging on her. It's an interesting pietà time format of Mother Mary holding Jesus. From long artistic tradition of that. But she's ignoring the child. She's just sitting there thinking her own thoughts, and the child is grasping around her. And then there's an older one sort of despairing above her. And then there's another dead figure down there on the rocks. The way to always read Blake's words and images, it's what he wants you to do. It's his parabolic method is what I refer to it. He's constantly throwing one thing next to another and asking you to think about it, just as you're saying. Respond to this. A parable means to throw beside. So he's throwing innocence besides experience. He's throwing his works next to Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, and he's constantly asking you to think for biblical connections, Greek mythology connections, and he's saying all this stuff is mythically exploring the same thing. So, the figure lying down there like that is Christ on the cross, so was the child dead on the ground. It's also Prometheus strapped to the rock for stealing fire and giving it to humanity, and then the gods come down, Zeus, and punishes Prometheus by nailing him to a rock for giving humans fire and making them take another step closer to the gods so that they will become like us. And Blake sees that Greek myth very much connected to the Christian myth, and Blake's whole worldview, that's the jealous gods who organized religion worships, but that's the wrong god. That's the oppressor god. So he's got a Prometheus figure, a poet figure, a Christ figure, and he's got Mother Mary here, who's cynical and is sick of the world, so she's not doing her business of raising her son Jesus.